May it please the court. I'm Knox Bemis. I represent the defendants, appellants of the Republic of Sudan and Interior Ministry of the Republic of Sudan. With the court's permission, I would like to reserve 5 minutes of my time for possible rebuttal. Thank you, Your Honor. Recently, on January 29, the plaintiffs' appellees filed an emergency motion which suggested that recent legislation that was came into effect January 28th of this year has divested this court of jurisdiction. This court denied that emergency motion, but unless this court has determined conclusively that it does have jurisdiction, that is, that the new statute did not divest it of jurisdiction, I would like to address that point first. The new legislation is Section 108.3 of the National Defense Authorization Act of 2008. A copy of this section is attached as Exhibit 2 to plaintiff's emergency motion. And to discuss this, I will have to track through the language of that section, and I would refer the court to the copy that has been provided by the plaintiff as an attachment to its emergency motion. Section 108.3, among other things, provided in Section A1 that the FSA is amended by inserting, a new Section 1605 capital A. It also provided that Section 1605 is amended by deleting the old Section 1605A7, which is the section under which this action was brought and has been prosecuted. Now, the new section, 1605A, contains subsection F, which provides that in an action brought under this section, appeals from orders not conclusively ending the litigation may only be taken pursuant to 1292B. And of course, this appeal was taken, this is a Cohen appeal, an interlocutory appeal that is not under 1292B. Mm-hmm. Now, the statute provides, as I just read, that an appeal may not be taken. Now, taking an appeal is a familiar concept, and in fact, it appears in this court's rules, Rule 3A1, which provides that an appeal permitted by law as of right from a district court to a court of appeals may be taken only by filing a notice of appeal with the district court. So, taking an appeal, a familiar concept, occurs when the notice of appeal is filed. And of course, in this case, that happened long before the enactment of the legislation.
What does this language under this section mean in subdivision F?
That's a good question, Your Honor. I don't know. I believe that and I will show that I think it's clear that the application of this subsection is prospective only. The first question would be whether it applies to appeals in the future where the action was brought under the old 1605A7. But of course, that question does not affect the issue here, because not only was this action brought under the old 1605A7, but the appeals were taken under 1605A7 and before the enactment of the new statute. At this point, with the language that I have pointed the court to, there is no retroactive effect. Now, plaintiffs point to section 1083C1, which appears at pages 5 and 6 of the attachment, the copy of the statute attached to the emergency motion. Now, that provides as follows.
I'm sorry, which section again?
Excuse me? It's section 1083C1. It starts at the bottom of page 5 of the attachment and goes over to the top of page 6. This is the provision that plaintiffs argue gives the provision retroactive effect. It says, the heading is application-dependent cases. And it reads, the amendments made by this section shall apply to any claim arising under section 1605A, that is the new section of Title 28. Now, that certainly does not expressly provide a retroactive effect. It simply says that the amendments shall apply. Now, plaintiffs would like to read that section to apply retroactively, even though it doesn't so provide. They'd like to read it to provide an effect that no prior action taken in a Section 1605A7 proceeding can be effective unless it also complies with the new provision of Section 1605A. But it doesn't say that.
So your point, I take it, is that this case, which, as you made a point before, was already appealed before to our court.
The appeal was taken.
The appeal had been taken. Is not a case, does not involve a claim arising under 1605A, the new 1605A.
Mm-hmm. Yes, even if it were a claim arising under 1605A, Section 1605A-F would not have retroactive effect to divest this court of jurisdiction. What 1605A-F speaks to is the taking of an appeal.
Yes, I understand.
Yeah, right.
Now you're focusing us on application-dependent cases.
Right.
Right. Isn't the key there whether this case arises under 1605A?
My point, the point I'm trying to make, Your Honor, is that whether or not it arises under 1605A, 1605AF does not divest this court of jurisdiction. It doesn't divest this court of jurisdiction even if this case is now deemed to arise under the new section. It does not divest this court of jurisdiction because it does not say that even if this action is deemed to arise under the new section, that 1605AF is retroactive. It simply now has come into effect. And that subsection speaks to taking an appeal. The appeals in this case have been taken long since.
I'm not getting your point because you were referring us also, I thought, mm-hmm. to Section 1605AC, application-dependent cases.
Yeah,
no?
That is correct.
Yep. Okay, and so you don't need that section for the argument you just stated.
Yeah.
I direct the court's attention to that section simply because that's what the plaintiffs say gives this retroactive effect. The point I'm trying to make is that that section 1083C1 does not
override the previous one that you referred to.
Yeah, it doesn't purport to give the new subsection F right. retroactive
well,
effect.
I think there's an additional point which I thought you were making, but perhaps not, that in any event, this is not a claim arising under
yes.
the new statute because you're not alleging the federal cause of action made available in this.
That is correct.
You're relying upon framed up your complaint under and your intent to rely upon the old and more limited provision.
Your Honor is correct. That is an additional reason why this does not apply. The point I was trying to make is that even however you interpret that, there's still no retroactive effect here. The other point I would make on this is that, as I pointed out, 1605AF speaks in terms of taking an appeal. If Congress had intended to divest the court of jurisdiction in pending cases, the appellate courts of jurisdiction in pending cases, it's easy to provide that in unambiguous language. You simply say the court is divested of jurisdiction in pending appeals, except 1292B appeals that are pending under 1605A7. As I'm sure the court is aware, there is a presumption against retroactivity, a case that we didn't cite, of course, because this issue wasn't present when we briefed, is Landsgraf versus USI Film Products, 511 U.S. 244, a case that we did cite, the Carlisle Towers case. Does have a discussion of this presumption.
Now, does that presumption apply if we treat this as a procedural change rather than as a substantive change?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe it does. What Landsgraf does...
Are you saying that there's no difference in the presumption with regard to changes in procedural law as opposed to changes in substantive law?
As I understand it, Your Honor, the distinction is this. The courts, and Landsgraf points this out, mm-hmm. The courts have given immediate effect to statutes that expressly confer or withdraw jurisdiction. One of the cases that plaintiffs cited, Balakin, is a sort of case where the a statute had expanded the jurisdiction of the district court while the case was on appeal. The appellate court applied that in deciding the appeal. But that is a situation that applies where the statute has expressly given or taken away jurisdiction. This is not such a statute, as I pointed out. It's directed to taking an appeal. I'm running short on time here, I see. I would address, I think most of what I would have to say is covered in the brief, although, of course, I'd be happy to answer any questions. The one thing I would like to point out is that in the argument on unconstitutional delegation of the Congress's power to limit, to define the jurisdiction of the federal courts, the Ryan case is the only other appellate court case, that's a Second Circuit case, that has addressed the issue that is raised in our argument here, that is the argument that there's an unconstitutional delegation because the statute has permitted the State Department, the executive of the State Department, to pick the defendants over whom the court has subject matter jurisdiction. Now, Ryan upheld the statute, but it was on the basis of two things. But one of the bases was that the statute was originally enacted in 1996 after the Terrorist Act had occurred and after the foreign state, Libya, was on the list. So the Ryan court deemed that the Congress had thereby approved the list as it stood. In the emergency motion, plaintiffs suggest that the new legislation, which substitutes a new section 1605A for the old section 1605A7, has the same effect here as far as sanctioning past additions to and deletions from the list of state sponsors of terrorism. I think it's clear that it does not. There's nothing in the statute or in, as far as I can find in the legislative history, that indicates Congress paid any attention at all to the State Department's conduct of the list.
There's a case called Marshall Field and Company versus Clark, 1892, in the Supreme Court. Defense did not cite it, but let me tell you this. There was a delegation challenge in that case. The law in question gave the president the power to suspend, aspect of international trade law upon making a certain finding. Here's what the court said. As the suspension was absolutely required when the president ascertained the existence of a particular fact, it cannot be said that in ascertaining that fact and in issuing his proclamation in obedience to the legislative will, that he exercised the function of making laws. Legislative power was exercised when Congress declared that the suspension should take effect upon a named contingency. Mm-hmm. The president was the mere agent of the lawmaking department. Isn't that similar to this situation?
There are several distinctions, Your Honor. I think the principal one is that the standards provided here to govern the State Department's action are not sufficient to permit that sort of to give specific direction to the State Department.
So you're saying no intelligible principle?
Intelligible principle is a fairly low hurdle, Your Honor, which has applied to the delegation of legislative functions, of course. This is a different sort of delegation, Article III delegation in question. But
why is it different? Why is it different? The definition of the court's jurisdiction, defining of the court's jurisdiction, is a legislative function, is it not?
Well, it's a power delegated to Congress under Article III, and they would do that through legislation. But it is. It's different from delegating, the power to write regulations governing national forests and things of that sort, which have, of course, long been upheld subject to the intelligible principle set.
Other than ipsy-dixit, how is that? What's the distinction that makes a difference between those two kinds of legislative function being delegated, if they're two different kinds?
Distinction is that Article III defines the power exists under Article III, and it's a different sort of function to define the jurisdiction of the courts that it is to lay down regulations governing trade or conduct of the property. I think it's a higher function. It's a function of a different sort. It's a power to define. It in fact is a huge power, Your Honor. It is the power to limit this court's jurisdiction, the jurisdiction of any federal court. As we all know, Congress has from time to time withdrawn the jurisdiction of the courts, federal courts, over broad areas that are within the constitutional scope.
Yeah.
I would argue it's a different sort of jurisdiction. And if I may, Excuse me?
You mean a different sort of delegation?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor.
Well, the Congress cannot do that, change the jurisdiction of the Supreme Court. Right? Cannot supplement it, as we learned in Marbury versus Madison, and by the text of the Constitution, it can't.
Correct, Your Honor. My remarks should be considered as addressing the lower court's jurisdiction.
Yes, in the lower courts, the Congress has expressed power to establish them from time to time,
right,
and as we learned in 1801, to abolish them.
Right.
From time to time.
Right.
So if it can abolish the courts under its power in Article III, I'm not sure why it requires a greater exercise or greater specificity for it to, when it defines the jurisdiction of those courts, than would be required under Article One.
Well, if it abolishes jurisdiction, that's quite clear what the effect is. I think it's different to abolish the court's jurisdiction altogether and to...
If you're saying that this is different because it involves the relations between the branches, that this is more fundamental in some way,
mm-hmm.
that here you have Congress exercising a power that defines the third branch. It can't do that with respect to the Supreme Court. It cannot.
No.
So it can never take away or supplement the jurisdiction of the third branch.
Altogether.
It can tailor how it's to be exercised.
Well, Your Honor, it could, however, eliminate Section 1605A7 or 1605A. It could withdraw the jurisdiction of the courts from that kind of case. It could withdraw it altogether.
Of the lower courts?
Yes, of the lower courts. Well, yes, yes. But the fact that it can withdraw such jurisdiction altogether doesn't mean that it can delegate to the executive branch the power to define the scope of the jurisdiction which it has established.
Well, if it were as open-ended as that, I would have to agree with you. Mm-hmm. I just, the executive branch, you just tell the courts what jurisdiction they have. That would probably be impermissible.
Yeah.
But here they've said if the president makes a certain finding.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. Yes. That is correct. My point on that really is that the standard is so imprecise, and the State Department's practice in implementing that standard has been not governed by neutral principles, I would say.
Let me ask you this. In the current complaint, the amended complaint,
mm-hmm.
you have alleged, and may have been an earlier complaint as well, you've alleged that without the material support, assistance, and aid provided by the Sudanese government, Al-Qaeda could not have carried out the U.S. Embassy bombings that caused plaintiff's injuries.
That is in the plaintiff's complaint, yes, that's what they alleged.
Yeah, I'm sorry, that's in the question. What is the standard that they're going to have to meet here in terms of causation?
They have to allege facts that show a cause in fact. What you just read, Your Honor, I would describe as conclusory. They simply have said that the material support that was provided between 91 and 96, they've simply said, ipsy dixit, that without that support, the Al-Qaeda could not have carried out the embassy bombings.
Now, the provision of they made an evidentiary proffer with respect to the provision of that support, not to its necessity, right? So what's left?
Yes, Your Honor.
Assuming that's proven up,
yes.
The element yet to be explored is the necessity of that support.
Yes, the causal relationship between that support and the bombings.
And you describe that as what? As cause in fact?
Cause in fact, yes.
If does the same standard of pleading specificity apply in this kind of case as would apply in, for example, a torts case here under diversity jurisdiction?
No, Your Honor. I think a higher standard applies.
Okay, why?
Because
it looks to me like the kind of notice pleading that we are accustomed to seeing in reviewing torts actions. So why is there a different standard here?
The standards applicable to pleading a claim are in Rule 8A2.
Mm-hmm.
Language for pleading jurisdiction is in Rule 8A1. The language is similar, but the courts have consistently held that the standards for pleading jurisdiction are higher. You've got to plead the facts that support jurisdiction.
We've allowed for more discovery, we've allowed for the finding of facts by district courts on motions attacking the jurisdiction, but so far as the sufficiency vel non at a dismissal point, do you have authority for a higher standard of pleading specificity? If you come in and ask for a hearing on those facts, or ask for a more definite and certain statement, or some discovery, it might be a different case, but when we're talking at a dismissal motion, do you have authority for that higher standard you're giving us?
Authority is cited in our brief.
Remind me of it.
Well, first of all, there are the cases pleading diversity. You can't simply plead that diversity exists. You've got to name the states of which the parties are citizens. I think the Robinson case, a Second Circuit case, is a good example, where the complaint was dismissed because the plaintiffs had failed to plead with sufficient specificity the facts supporting the alleged negligence. That was a tort exception case, so that this wasn't simply pleading a cause of action under 8A2. It was pleading the basis for jurisdiction under the FSIA.
Well, what about the cases that have dealt specifically with jurisdictional causation under the FSIA?
Yes.
And have said that all the plaintiffs need to demonstrate is a reasonable connection between Sudan's actions, mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. The bombings.
Yes, Your Honor, that's a good point. The Rux case said that, and I believe the court below said that. That simply is not what the statute says. The statute says caused by. If reasonable connection means something less than that, it doesn't comply with the statute. Simple as that. There are a number of cases discussed in our brief. I'd certainly be happy to answer any questions, but I see my time has expired. I do hope I have at least a minute or so to reply if that is necessary.
Further questions?
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Davis.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Stephen Perlis. I represent the plaintiffs below, appellees above in this matter. Having heard the argument that just took place, it might be logical for us to use a question that Judge Sentell posed as a jumping off point for the beginning of my argument this morning. Section 1605A7 no longer exists. This is not, or effective next week when we file an amended complaint, as amended complaints are going to be filed, I suspect, in all pending terrorism exception cases, this will become an A7 case. And that raises two threshold jurisdictions for the court, one that the court has begun exploring, and that's whether or not it continues to have jurisdiction in this case. The other one is the question of mootness. If we are going to be filing an amended complaint in this case, and I think the statute requires that we do that within 60 days, and I'm prepared to proffer we'll be doing that next week, where is the claim and controversy for the court to hear at the present time? Seems to me we're going to be looking at a new complaint next week, and whether or not the court has jurisdiction, I don't think it does at this point. Certainly, there'll be a new complaint, and the court also has to address as a threshold question mootness. You'll be looking at an A7 case, and we're certainly entitled, if we choose to replead factual allegations next week.
This was an A7 complaint.
I'm sorry. Are we talking about old A7 or are we talking about new A? I'm sorry,
new
A.
No,
I'm sorry. excuse me if I've misspoken, next week, this is now a 1605 Big A case, and we're going to have to refile a complaint next week. We have 60 days from January 28th to refile that complaint. When that happens, the court is going to be faced with the problem of mootness. It's reviewing an appeal from a from an original complaint that will have been amended as a matter of right under the new statute.
Okay, let me just ask you to restate this. This is really important.
Okay,
we're to clarify. You, your complaint was filed under the old statute.
That is correct.
You intend to file a complaint under the new statute.
I think we are required to file.
I believe you're required
to file a complaint. Yes.
And what will be the status of that complaint, considering that this matter is pending appeal?
Yeah.
What will you want the district court to do with it?
Well, what I would like.
Litigate both cases?
Not at all.
Not
at all. I mean, what I would like to see happen is that the matter at this point be remanded back for further proceedings consistent with the new statute, so that administratively we're in an orderly process where the district court can look at issues within the context of the new statute and the amended complaint we're filing, because that would seem to be the only orderly way that in which we can get through this process. I'm not, certainly would be silly for me to stand here and suggest that the district court below should proceed in consideration of that complaint. But nonetheless, I'm in a position.
Is it your preference to file a new complaint, or are you doing it only because you understand the statute to compel it?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
Is it your preference to file under the new statute, or do you believe, are you doing it solely because you believe that you are compelled to do that?
No, I'm doing it because I'm compelled to do it.
You would rather not?
It's not a question of rather not. The section under which the old complaint was brought no longer exists.
Well, but whether the change in the law applies to pending cases is a matter that we have not decided. And if we decided that it does not, you would have an option of defending this appeal, or under the statute you have the option pretty clearly of refiling under the new statute.
I never viewed this appeal as particularly difficult to defend, so quite frankly I'm ambivalent about that question.
If you refile, will you be taking advantage of the new federal cause of action?
Yes, we will.
And how can you be ambivalent? Isn't that of material assistance, let's say, to your cause?
It is of material assistance to us. And certainly from that perspective, I prefer to be under the new statute. But from the perspective of defending this appeal, there are two defenses that have been asserted here, and I don't find either one of them to be meritorious. I mean, if you're asking me, would I prefer to proceed under the uniform federal damage standards that are now implemented by 1605A? Certainly, I prefer to be under those standards. I was recently involved in a case below, Peterson versus the Islamic Republic of Iran, where the difficulties associated with the lack of uniform damage standards really became paramount, and quite frankly was one of the driving forces in Congress's decision to move this case along, or to move the new statute along. What happened
in other words, to overrule Sicipio?
To overrule Sicipio. What happened in Peterson is that action arose from Iran's bombing of the Beirut Marine Barracks. There were, that is, for all practical purposes, a mass tort case. I believe there were plaintiffs in that case in 44 states. And what we saw in that case is substantially disparate damage awards given to similarly situated victims' families based on the vagaries of state law, in particular residents of Pennsylvania and Louisiana at the time of the bombing received substantially less than similarly situated victims from other states. Congress found, I think Judge Lamberth was correct in the way he awarded damages, but it manifested itself as a fundamentally unfair outcome and was one of the driving forces, as I say, in amending this statute. The other driving force in amending this statute was a case that I argued. Judge Santel was on the panel, and that was Beacom versus the Libyan Arab Republic. In that case, Libya took a collateral order doctrine appeal from a meet and confer order. And ultimately, Judge Santel's panel ruled that such collateral order doctrine appeal was several, I believe the language used by the panel, was several steps removed from the court's jurisdiction. The effect of that, however, was to chew up a two-year block of time. So the 90 disabled veterans who were involved in that case saw their claim delayed by 2 years. Now, we also know that Libya, had we gone forward with jurisdictional discovery after that, Libya would have taken another collateral order doctrine appeal under In re Papandreou. In fact, the Libyans made it quite clear that at every possible opportunity, they would be taking collateral order doctrine appeals. That essentially means that if you bring one of these cases, it would have been impossible to get one of them even into ordinary discovery in less than 6 or 8 years. And that's an
6 or 8 years?
6 or 8 years. 6 or 8 years. What happens is, look at the LaBelle case, for example. That's Beacom. The Beacom case is now going into its seventh year. We still don't have a ruling on Libya's initial motion to dismiss. And that's because of the procedural difficulties below that collateral order doctrine appeals created under old 1605A7. Congress's response to that was to try and normalize the process by saying that if a state who is a defendant under 1605A believes that it has a meritorious defense that it wants to take up, should go to the trial judge like any other party and ask for an interlocutory appeal be certified.
While we're at the statute and recognizing that time is a finite thing here, what is it about the statute itself that makes us sure that this is the statute applies to pending cases? I take it it's your position that it does.
Oh, it does apply.
The other side certainly wasted a lot of time knocking that down if it's not your position. Well,
and I apologize for that, Your Honor. There's a section number 2. Which refers to prior
actions. That's under C, right?
That is correct, prior actions. In general, with respect to any action that, and I won't continue on, but the court began their inquiry into that section in their discussion with Mr. Bemis a few minutes ago.
What about the section?
Yeah, go ahead.
This section clearly shows that Congress contemplated a retroactive application. But beyond that, the basic structure of this statute contemplates retroactive application. If Congress had not contemplated retroactive application, it simply would have amended 1605A7 and left it in some amended form where it exists in Title 28. Instead, it repealed 1605A7 and started again with a new 1605 Big A.
There are some provisions in this new statute that seem difficult to reconcile with that position. If I can find the references, I'll let you take a crack at them.
While you're looking, that section you referred to does expressly refer to some effects on pending cases. It does not mention the interlocutory appellate subsection.
No, it does not, Your Honor.
Does that cut against you, that it mentions some and doesn't mention yours?
I think that it is a reflection of Congress's focus on the problem that I discussed rather than their focus on the question of pending cases.
C2A, you have us looking at C1. C2A. With respect to any action that was brought under the old statute, and that relied upon that provision as creating a cause of action. And as of such date of enactment is before the courts in any form, that would include this action, right? That action shall, on motion by the plaintiffs, be given effect as if the action had originally been filed under 1605A, the new statute.
Correct.
On motion of the plaintiffs. So if there's no motion of the plaintiffs, the matter continues under the old statute.
But that brings us back to the conundrum that you and I just discussed. I believe I have a duty under the new statute to file a complaint, and we will be filing an amended complaint next week.
Where does that arise? Where does that obligation arise? Where do you find the obligation? Where's that 60-day limit? C3, I believe.
Yeah, I believe Your Honor is correct that it is C3.
But that says that you may, that where, let's see.
It's
any other action arising out of the same act or incident may be brought under the new statute if within 60 days.
Right.
Right? Maybe. Again, it's an option for the plaintiff.
I understand, but old section A7 is gone.
Well, but
it doesn't exist.
The question of whether this case can be should continue to be litigated under old A7.
I don't see how this case can be litigated under a section of the United States Code that's been repealed.
If the repealer provides that it applies only to doesn't apply to pending cases, then it can be litigated under the old statute.
But the repealer here gives no indication.
I just gave you two. The plaintiff may file the motion to switch to the new statute, right? And if you decide you want to do that, you've got to do it within 60 days. I mean, it's quite conditional in the statute. May. Now, you're not obligated.
But I think Congress's intent there was not to say you may use the new statute or the old statute. It was to say you may file a complaint or
you may. 60 days or you lose your action.
You may file a complaint or you may file your do it by motion instead, but you've got to do something within 60 days. So the may is to one option or the other. That's right. Not to whether or not a new action has to be filed. And I think that certainly is the context in which people in Congress explored that question.
Well, the 60 days, and let's go a little further on the 60
okay.
days. The 60 days, not later than the latter of 60 days after A, the date of the entry of judgment in the original action under the old statute, or the date of enactment of this statute. That implies that judgment could be entered in an action brought under the old statute after enactment of this statute. Otherwise, there could be no ladder. It would always, the enactment of the statute would always be the event. But if the entry of judgment can be the later event, then apparently this court was not ousted of jurisdiction.
Yeah.
Got it? The statute passes on day one, and entry of judgment is on day 10. Or you get until day 60 if you want to switch your case to the new statute.
Yeah. That section, I don't believe that section means what Your Honor
read it to say.
Read it to say. That's
correct. I was
quoting
it. Okay.
I understand that.
Tell us what it means then, counsel.
It means that you have to come in and file an amended, either an amended complaint or a motion.
After judgment?
The after judgment portion applies to something else. The number of people went to Congress who were victims of terror.
Let's get to the statute.
Okay. That's intended to allow parties to be added to pending claims after judgment.
But under the new statute?
Under the new statute.
What? So, and if they're not added, then what? Then the judgment entered after the new statute is valid.
The judgment there refers to a 1605A judgment, not a 1605A7 judgment.
Now listen, this is C3 now. If an action arising out of an act or incident has been timely commenced under the old statute, A7, that's the predicate for this whole section. The date of entry of judgment in the original action, that means under the old section. Or the date of enactment of this act, whichever is the latter. So that clearly implies the entry of judgment in the original action may come after enactment of this act, which implies that the court was not ousted of jurisdiction over the old action when the statute was passed.
Give me just a moment, please. Thank you.
Your answer is that there are irreconcilable contradictions in the statute. I will agree with you.
You could perhaps posit a case that's pending on appeal where a final judgment has not been entered at the time of the enactment of the statute.
But there's nothing in here about adding parties. It's bringing an action.
No, I understand. This is the Congress's legislative council's attempt to build the bridging mechanism between the end of the 1605A7 cases and the initiation of the new 1605A cases.
But it necessarily assumes that a judgment could be entered in a case brought under the old statute after enactment of the new statute.
What legislative...
Which is why I posited, does that refer perhaps, or does that allow for cases that are pending on appeal where a final judgment has not been entered? Could that be the reason for it?
Well, that's correct. Or cases where a final judgment has been entered under 1605A7 and they are pending on appeal.
I guess that's more what I meant to say.
That's right. I mean, in fact, that is the specific reason why this provision is in here. Whether it does unintended things is a different question altogether. But
thank you to do that.
That is a problem. but this provision was inserted so that cases that are final judgments under 1605A7 can receive the benefits of 1605A treatment by alternatively the filing of a new complaint under 1605A or by motion.
Well, I think that much is clear. The only question is whether that implies that the courts are not ousted of jurisdiction on the enactment
yes,
date.
But that is a mechanism which is converting those final 1605A7 judgment cases to 1605A cases. There's nothing in this statute which would indicate that Congress intended that 1605A7 cases would continue.
Should we try another one?
We can
look at two or three now.
I have 2 minutes.
Let's look at 1083C or whatever, 1605C4. Okay. Preserving the jurisdiction of the courts.
Okay. I'm sorry, you are on?
I'm on C4 of 1605A.
1605A. C.
Right after related actions, that was C3.
Yeah.
Okay, now we're preserving the jurisdiction of the courts, C4.
The last subsection under C comes right before D, applicability to Iraq.
I see. Okay. Thank you.
This section provides that the Emergency Wartime Supplemental Appropriations Act, makes it clear, I guess, that act did not, nothing in that has ever authorized, an odd provision in the statute, it's more like a resolution or something.
Yeah.
As nothing in that 2003 statute, we're now saying in 2007 or 8, which is, nothing in that 2003 statute authorized the president to make any provision of the act inapplicable to Iraq. And of course, in RC against Iraq, we had said the
yes.
president did not have that power. At the same time, the next provision, D1, authorizes the president to waive any provision of the current statute with respect to Iraq. So it wouldn't make sense for the Congress to codify the holding in our case, the president had no power under the 2003 statute, in light of the waiver power under the 2008 statute, unless something other than judgments under the 2008 statute are at issue or proceedings, and that would be proceedings still going on under the, going forward under the old statute.
I would respectfully say that you read much too much into the tortured attempt to apply this statute to the ACRI case. The language in Section 4 was inserted at the by Congress at the request of the ACRI plaintiffs. The president then...
By the way, how do we document that?
You know, there's absolutely no way to document that. There is no way to
Thank
document
you for
that.
The
no, but you know, certainly
let's
it's a matter.
Take that as an assumption.
As an assumption, okay. Certainly, it's a matter of public record that the president, after saying he would sign the bill, became concerned about this paragraph, and vetoed this bill because of its potential impact on Iraq. And then a negotiation ensued between the Congress and the President, which resulted in the insertion of, I guess it's a paragraph D, applicability to Iraq, effectively mooting this subparagraph 4.
Rendering a questionable paragraph. As you say, virtually moot.
That's correct. I mean, that's
so
why
you're asking us to treat the statute as though that section had no effect.
I do not believe it has an effect on any pending cases, given the fact that the president has signed the waiver mechanism provided for in paragraph D. That's correct.
Well, no. You have to look, the question is how to interpret the statute, not in light of the president's subsequent waiver, but rather whether, contrary to innumerable instructions from the Supreme Court, we ought to construe the statute as having a whole provision that is mere surplusage. Which it might have. But that's what you want.
Paragraph 4 is moot in the face of the addition of the subparagraph 4. It is really moot with the addition of paragraph D,
passed,
applicability to Iraq.
The moment it was passed, or in this case repassed, really,
let's correct.
It was mere surplusage.
That is correct. Terms. Yes.
Well, the court says to strive to avoid that. It doesn't say it's impossible.
It's actually a darn good thing in lots of instances that it doesn't say it's impossible.
But
it wouldn't be the first time we were unable to achieve.
When we start holding provisions meaningless, there lies chaos.
Yeah.
That brings us to a very interesting point. The issues discussed today, and there have been very few merits issues discussed today, remain unbriefed. I must tell you, as a practitioner, that makes me very uncomfortable. I think the briefing process in this court is a terrific part of the adversarial process in this country. If the court would welcome a briefing on these issues, we certainly would be more than amenable to briefing them out for the court.
Well,
and I would hope that process would be instructive for you.
And if we do, we'll give you both the schedule. It is a thorny situation. On the other hand, you want to cut the Gordian knot with your amended complaint, right, and ask us to remand and not deal with any of these.
If you're asking what my preferred outcome is, yes, we would like to cut the Gordian knot by the filing of an amended complaint, and that have you remand the matter back for further proceedings consistent with the new statute.
Let me make sure. Your position is that we've lost jurisdiction.
First, you've lost jurisdiction.
Okay, if we've lost jurisdiction,
right,
then under Steel Company, I don't know that we can say anything more than that. We don't have any jurisdiction.
But that would be all they would need us to say.
I think that's right. Because
there would be no remand. We would dismiss for want of jurisdiction.
You could dismiss for want of jurisdiction.
But the case then would lie below.
You would start over down there.
We'd file an amended complaint.
And lay it out, if we decide that we do have jurisdiction, it would still be your preference that we not resolve the merits, but rather remand for the district court, rather to proceed on your amended complaint.
Yes, based on mootness. That's correct.
So that crystallizes the issue of whether we can remand a case without determining that we have jurisdiction.
Right.
But what we would be dismissing would be the appeal and not the case. The ongoing litigation would still lie below and you could make your motion to amend.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
Yeah. Don't look to Mr. Bemis to oblige you by withdrawing.
You know,
although it might be a good idea.
Anything else? Okay. Thank you,
Thank you, Your Honor. By the way, Mr. Bemis and I are going to appear on a panel at the judicial conference this year to discuss this subject, so maybe we'll have an opportunity in an academic setting to kick this around a little bit again.
We seem to get academic at times this morning.
Thank you, Your Honor.
But that's the beauty of the court.
It is.
May it please the court, no, we were not obliged by withdrawing the appeal.
Are you sure that's not in your best interest to withdraw the appeal? You're running the risk of a merits decision against you that might be worse to you than a withdrawn appeal, aren't you?
Your Honor, I think there's an advantage in having an answer, at least, to those questions right away. We would also take the position that the appeal would not be moot, certainly the issue of the constitutional issue, the Article III issue, would be the same under the new statute as under the old. Whether the other issue, the allegation showing causation, would be moot, depends on what the new allegations, if any, in the amended complaint say.
You know, the new statute exposes you to punitive damages, is that correct?
It purports to. It provides for punitive damages, yes, Your Honor.
Did you want to correct anything Mr. Perla said?
Your Honor, I think that unless the court has questions, I will leave it at that.
We have nothing but questions. We're looking for answers for an hour. And you've both done your best to give them. We'll reprise this at the circuit conference in June.
Excuse me?
I guess we'll reprise this at the circuit conference in June.
Yes, right.
Until then, thank you. The case is submitted.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.